You have been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning, the views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
That's right, exercise your choice. Welcome again to the truth-defying, hard-hitting alternative voice for Central Wisconsin, the Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show. Each week the show brings you reports and voices from around the country and our world. Voices you will hear not on the mainstream media. These are alternative voices to the dogma most love to hear and regurgitate for you. Here is your chance to choose something else. Example, have you heard anything about the short breaking news item on this last weekend's mainstream media press?
This is In the News with breaking news on Saturday, May 13th. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Jason Leopold of Truth Out reports that Karl Rove will be and has been delivered papers for indictment on charges of perjury and lying to investigators and possibly obstruction of justice. Jason Leopold writes in Truth Out at truthout.org that Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald spent more than half a day Friday at the offices of Patton Boggs, the law firm representing Karl Rove. During the course of that meeting, Fitzgerald served attorneys for former Deputy White House Chief of Staff Karl Rove with an indictment charging the embattled White House official with perjury and lying to investigators related to his role in the CIA leak case, and instructed one of the attorneys to tell Rove that he has 24 hours to get his affairs in order. High-level sources with direct knowledge of the meeting said Saturday morning again, Karl Rove will be indicted on charges of perjury and lying to investigators and possibly obstruction of justice. This again from Jason Leopold, breaking news from Truth Out at truthout.org. I'm Scott Berguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Talk to you next time.
That's right. Karl Rove is going to be indicted according to truthout.org. However, did anyone on a Sunday morning Yak shows talk about this as even a possibility? Nope. I tuned into most of this past Sunday's morning news shows. My favorite was a show that had Newt Gingrich on for about a half an hour, telling us about how good Hillary was at debates. Ain't it nice how the right gets to tell the left who should be running for president? They would really like that too, for she would have no chance of winning, and then they could put any knucklehead back in 2006. So yeah, keep drinking that Kool-Aid. Anyway, I digress. The point is, no news reports about Rove's indictments on Main Street Press, and I suspect not much on the other all-hate AM radio stations here in town either. So that's why I do this show each week. To give you news and information you'll not hear anywhere else in Central Wisconsin airways, except each Monday for the 4 hours on this all-independent radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. If you're choosing wisely and listening to the show, you'll note that the shows that I am putting on to you are produced on other not-for-profit and or community-based radio stations like the one you're listening to now, WNRB. These are all non-corporate voices. Coming up next, a very good example of an alt-indie media radio program, the 20-minute weekly news roundup I try to bring you each week out of Seattle, Washington, called Eat the State. As always, thanks for listening to this Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio program for Central Wisconsin.
It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you. You were mentioning earlier off the air that you didn't like bubbly people, so I'm going to try and reform myself.
Oh, I just said I have trouble adjusting to that speed at this hour of the morning.
Yeah, well, yeah, I do too. Okay.
All right. Enough of that. We're going to start with the national this week instead of local, since there's so much stuff happening nationally. So
yeah, and you know, a lot of it doesn't lend itself to bubbly and cheerful, actually.
No. Starting out with, it looks like people need to start marking their calendars for Karl Rove's.
Yeah, interesting report that came out last night by Jason Leopold in Truthout, and I've quoted him on this program before. He's generally been right on the money and about a week ahead of mainstream media in terms of development in the Valerie Plame case and Patrick Fitzgerald's probe. He is reporting that Rove met with President Bush and with Bush's chief of staff, Joshua Bolten, this week, told them that he is going to be indicted, both on perjury and possibly also on obstruction of justice charges, and that when that happens, he will resign his post in the administration. If this is true, and certainly all indications of the last few weeks have been leading that way, it's a tremendous blow to Republicans, because, of course, Rove recently took over, rather he stepped back from his policy job in the White House to focus on helping the Republicans save their bacon in the November elections. And, of course, that job gets more difficult every week with the various scandals that roll out, of which we had another doozy this week. We'll get to that in a second. But Rove is by far the best strategist the Republicans have, and if he is on the sidelines and not available to them, or certainly not available to Bush and to the Republican National Committee because he's under indictment and has to focus on his own case the way that Scooter Libby has, it's going to make their job even that much more difficult. Now, I'm sure that he's sketched out a game plan between now and November, but, you know, a lot can happen between now and November, and having a field general that can, you know, make changes and adjustments as they go is pretty important for a plan like that. And let's face it, the Republicans have not been noted recently for their strategic genius when it comes to image making and political acumen. So this is a really important development on a couple of fronts, both the Plame case itself and Bush's credibility himself, of course, because if Rove was involved, as he certainly appears that he was, Bush has had to know about it for some time. Rove answers to Bush in a way that Scooter Libby did not, and you know, Bush has been hiding this fact from the public for some time. But above and beyond all that, it's a tremendous strategic blow for the Republicans. So you know, it's a good, nice trifecta.
All right. Well, I can't imagine how it came as that great a surprise to the media and people in power, but looks like the NSA was reaching out and touching a lot more people than had previously been noted.
Yeah, about 200 million customers of AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South. Anybody with a Verizon wireless cellular phone contract ought to be reconsidering that right about now. Quest, to its credit, and this will be the first time we've said anything nice about this on this program about Quest in the last 5 years. It was reported, at least in the USA Today article that came out on Thursday, as refusing to cooperate with the government's request that it hand over all of its phone records for data mining purposes by the NSA. Again, this was something that was hinted at, and if not outright reported, back in December. The Boston Globe had a story saying the NSA was not just monitoring international telephone calls to and from suspected Al-Qaeda terrorists, but that it was using data mining operation to monitor the phone calls of many, many Americans on domestic calls. The LA Times had various articles that was pointing toward this sort of thing. The New York Times picked up off the Boston Globe article. I mean, this has been bubbling. There was even a lawsuit in San Francisco in January alleging this sort of thing. So this has been bubbling bubbling underneath the surface for months now. And why mainstream media has not picked the ball up and run with it sooner is anybody's guess. But that's the major reason why this report is being treated as so credible. You know, even though it's just from one news source from USA Today, and it doesn't actually quote any named sources, but it's being treated as credible because for people who've been following this, who are in the know, in the loop, it comes as no surprise. And again, for anybody in this country who thinks you have privacy in this country, you simply don't. The Fourth Amendment effectively no longer applies. It actually hasn't probably applied for the last 20 years, but it certainly hasn't applied after the Bush administration came into office, and it especially certainly hasn't applied after 9/11. So, you know, be advised. The question at this point has to do with the confirmation of General William Hayden, the former head of the NSA. His Senate confirmation hearings for him to take over the CIA from Porter Goss. Goss, of course, going down in flames around Hookergate and poker games at the Watergate, which also came out this week, as did the resignation of his number three man, a political crony named Dusty Fago. I don't know how you could make up a name like that. And incidentally, Fago's home and office were searched by the Department of Justice yesterday, so he's in trouble on possible corruption charges and other things. But Hayden is coming up for confirmation this week, and the one good thing that may come out of the this latest revelation in terms of the NSA has to do with the additional pressure it will put on Hayden's confirmation. Both from Democrats and Republicans are making noises about wanting to look at this more closely, and he'll have to testify under oath. Now, he has been asked in the past, not under oath, about whether political opponents of the White House have been targeted for spying, and he has refused to answer that question. It'll be very interesting to see if that question is posed under oath, and if so, what his response is. Probably very evasive. But one of the more disappointing things this past week was the reaction by Democrats to Hayden's nomination on Monday before this latest NSA spying scandal broke. Some Democrats were certainly concerned, but a number of them were not. Quite a few, like Dianne Feinstein, supported his nomination. It's the sort of thing where people keep waiting for the Democrats to act like a real opposition party. They've been making noise about the NSA warrantless domestic spying scandal since December, but then they wouldn't support Feingold's censure resolution, and now they were not in large number opposing Hayden's confirmation. But this is in many ways a politically explosive story, and it shouldn't be, both because people shouldn't be surprised and because if you count the different crimes of the Bush administration, I would count, you know, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 dead from an illegally launched war based upon lies in Iraq, probably to be at the top of the list. And there's probably five or six other major crimes that are a lot more alarming than listening to people's phone calls. But this is something that affects people perceive it to affect their daily lives very directly, and they feel invaded by it. So it's political dynamite in a way that, you know, the deaths of some brown people on the other side of the world do not. And so it's going to be very interesting to see what the media shelf life is on this, whether Democrats and Republicans, for that matter, pick up on the popular mood or the popular reaction to it, and just how low President Bush's approval ratings can go, because he's already down at 30%. This can do nothing but hurt him more.
Well, perhaps the Justice Department was raiding the House and office of Third in Command at CIA because they couldn't get any more movement with the NSA from the requests.
Yeah, that was another discouraging development this week, that the Justice Department announced that it was dropping its investigation into the warrantless domestic spying scandal at the NSA because the NSA wouldn't grant the Justice Department investigators security clearances to get the information they need to actually investigate the program. This, once again, is the White House, and in this case an agency under the direct control of the White House, asserting itself to be above the law. It's something that we're hearing again and again. And, you know, none of this is going to change unless you get, Senate and House investigative committees, investigations from committees that have the power of subpoena, that can force people under penalty of contempt of Congress to come in and testify, under oath. And that's almost certainly something that's not going to happen concerning the Bush White House in any kind of serious way, unless the Democrats can take back one or the other House in November. Whatever else you can or can't say about the mettle of the Democrats, that's one very important reason for trying to help them get control of the of Congress in November, or at least one House of Congress. It's not that they're going to institute sweeping reforms. It's not even that they particularly deserve the power. It's that there has to be some sort of accountability for the Bush administration for the crime that's committed against the Constitution and against the people of this country and the world. And that's not going to happen as long as the Republicans control Congress.
Well, speaking of above the law in a figurative and, in this case, a literal sense, there was an article this week about the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency.
Yeah, this is another not very widely noticed development this week involving an agency that virtually nobody has ever heard of. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency is the agency that controls the spy satellites and what they see. In other words, where it aims the camera, what it sees on the ground, and you know, compositing the different images, and they have a resolution capacity down to probably a few centimeters. They claim a meter, but I'll bet it's better than that. They had some publicity last fall for the pictures they were providing to people stricken by Katrina on the Gulf Coast, but basically they keep a very low profile. Well, the head of the NGIA, another military guy, Lieutenant General James Clapper, said in an interview this week that the NGIA has been doing a lot more domestic surveillance in recent years than it ever has been before. In fact, the number of analysts that they have hired has gone up 40% in the last 5 years, and a lot of that has gone toward domestic surveillance. Well, the NGIA is like the NSA. It's not supposed to be doing domestic surveillance. There's other agencies that do, you know, satellite mapping the United States and things like that. Why, again, are we conducting warrantless surveillance operations on Americans or on facilities on American soil? So this is yet another front in which our privacy is being violated by the Bush administration. And I guess it's just become so common that media doesn't even particularly notice at this point.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad the Department of Homeland Security bringing everybody under one roof is working out the bugs.
Well, at least we're under a roof so they can't see what we're doing underneath the cover.
Oh, I guess they can.
Yeah, well, those are the cameras placed inside the walls.
Well, they have many ways of going right through walls. Give us an update on Mr. Abramoff.
Yes, no news this week involving Mr. Abramoff himself, but one of his former employees, a guy who also, before being hired by Mr. Abramoff, in fact, directly before Mr. Abramoff hired him, he was the chief of staff for Republican Congressman from Ohio, Robert Nye, who has been under investigation for corruption for months now, and is frequently mentioned as the congressperson most likely to be indicted first in the Abramoff scandal. Was former chief of staff, a guy named Neil Volz, who had time to be indicted for 4 years worth of corruption from his time on Nye's staff and his time with Abramoff, and still only be 35 35 years of age, it really makes you wonder what qualifies guys like these to have such positions of power at such a young age, other than knowing the right folks in college or, you know, having a well-connected daddy or something. But in any event, he pled guilty this week. He's the fourth major figure to plead guilty in the Abramoff scandal. He pled guilty to, quote, participating in a conspiracy to corrupt Robert Nye, his staff, and other members of Congress. So that implies that people other than Nye are also under investigation, with trips, free tickets, and meals. There was probably more than that, of course, but that's what the guilty plea included. He faces up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. They are laying the groundwork here to go after Nye and to go after other members of Congress. The more people that they can have entering guilty pleas and cooperate with the federal investigation and offering their own files and their own information, the stronger the case will be when they start going after the really big fish. And you can count on that happening this summer and in the period leading up to the November election. We're going to be still hearing quite a bit more about Mr. Abramoff.
Hmm. All right. Also this week, speaking of big fish, there's some tax cuts for big fish.
Yes, but very little for the rest of us. The GOP in the House and the Senate reached agreement on a deal which would send $70 billion in Bush tax cuts through. It now has not – it passed the House immediately, has not passed the Senate yet, and there is a possibility that it won't pass the Senate. There have – in addition to solid Democratic opposition, there have been a few Republicans like Olympia Snowe who have said that they oppose the deal. So it's not clear it has the necessary votes, but it may well. What happened was that the larger package of Bush tax cuts got split into two. And what they did is they took the tax cuts that almost entirely benefit the rich, the wealthy, and they put them in one package. And they decided to pass that first because, of course, that's more politically important. And then they took the tax cut that's going through right now, for instance, extends the tax cuts on investment income, which promote how many lower income people get most of their income from in stock dividends and things like that. Part of the deal was that some of the other tax deductions, for example, that have expired that benefit primarily non-rich people, things like teachers being able to deduct the classes of supplies that they buy for their classroom, which most teachers have to do these days thanks to education budget cuts and No Child Left Behind, or deductibility of school tuition, things like that, that have already expired. Those were pushed off into a future tax cut package, and the reason they were is because the future tax cut package is less clear that it's going to be able to pass, and it's not because more people oppose it. It's because the taxes that are being cut or the tax cuts that are being extended in there cannot, through procedural rules in the Senate, be fast tracked. In other words, they can't do what they're trying to do with the $70 billion package that they're trying to ram through right now, which is to prohibit a filibuster and demand an up or down vote, so that instead of needing 50 votes to pass, the second tax cut package would probably need 60 votes to pass the Senate, because 40 Democrats or others filibustering could stop it. This means, of course, that the middle income or the middle class tax cuts they're being put in the future bill to sort of sweeten the pot, but they're also much more at risk of not happening, whereas the tax cuts for the rich that are in the current package are much more likely to happen. It really does tell you again where the Republican priorities are at, even though with record national deficits right now, you can pretty much gather where their priorities are at if this is a priority right now anyway.
All right. And then moving along to Little Fish, there's a Medicare deadline coming up on Monday?
Yes, there is. For signing up for the Part D prescription drug program, I had a column on this week at Working for Change, and people can read all the ugly details there. But it's a tremendously flawed program. I'm eligible, and I'm not signing up for it because I can't risk it. There's too many ways in which it can backfire for people who are signed up. There are a lot of activists that are trying to get the May 15th, the deadline extended. That almost certainly will not happen before Monday. There is some movement even among Republicans to try and extend it in the future. However, President Bush has said that he will veto any legislation to fix any part of Part D, either extending the deadline or changing or abolishing the 1% per month. That is a minimum of 7% because you can't sign up for it again now that the registration deadline is passing until the end of the year. A 1% per month permanent lifetime surcharge if you don't sign up for it by Monday. There's a number of other problems with this plan. I say also it's tremendously flawed. It's a huge piece of corporate welfare for the insurance and especially the drug industries. We're kind of short on time, but if you want to read all the ugly details, it was in Working for Change this week. It'll be in Seattle Weekly next week.
All right. You talked about last week, Divine Strike. There is a delay.
Yes, there is. There's a lawsuit, which is why there's a delay. The Winnemucca Indian Tribe and several other aggrieved parties that would be downwind from this test at the Nevada test site, which we talked about, is basically a dry run for a nuclear strike on Iran. They're trying to calibrate what size of a nuclear strike would affect the underground nuclear facilities in Iran. And so they're doing a simulated nuclear explosion. That basically is the same kind of explosive that was used in the Oklahoma City bombing, only way more. It'll be a huge explosion. It has been delayed from June 2nd to at least June 23rd. How much longer than that it's delayed depends a lot on publicity and on how the lawsuit proceeds. And a lot of people still haven't heard about this, so spread the word. It's pretty outrageous.
All right. Can we jump over to international, or did you have anything else on national that you needed to cover?
Well, I would mention that Hillary Clinton and Rupert Murdoch are getting in bed together, but I can address that on the ETS blog.
All right. Well, you were talking about Iran, and there was a letter sent by the Iranian president.
Yes, President Ahmadinejad, I'll learn how to say that eventually, sent an 18-page letter to President Bush. It was the first official communication between the two governments since the 1978 Iranian Revolution. And what was remarkable about this letter wasn't so much the content. The president of Iran basically just reiterated a lot of his grievances and urged Bush, as somebody who claims to believe in Jesus, to live up to his religion's professed beliefs, which is something I've always wondered about. But what was more interesting was that this letter was widely reprinted in media outlets all over the world. Le Monde had a translation, the BBC ran it, it was run throughout the Middle East, etc. But aside from the Washington Post, I could find hardly any other media outlets in the United States that ran this letter. It begs the question, why? Why don't we find out what people who are designated as enemies of the state are saying and, are allowed to judge for ourselves whether they're rational or not?
All right. Also this week, it is becoming very evident that people in Palestine are under gross economic hardships.
Yeah, this is something that's been developing for weeks now because of the economic sanctions and effectively economic blockade that's being imposed by the United States and Israel especially, and to a lesser degree the European Union. But where it's hitting the hardest and the fastest is in medical facilities, especially on the Gaza Strip. You're starting to see people, especially folks on dialysis, diabetics, etc., die due to lack of medication, lack of supplies for dialysis, this sort of thing, in the hospitals. And as with many other things that Israel does, and for that matter many other things that the U.S. does, it's just a gross violation of human rights and of international law that it's the sick and the weakest that are essentially being targeted and being made to pay for, in this case, what was a democratic choice and a fair election by the Palestinian people. And again, U.S. media is barely covering it at all.
All right. Well, speaking of elections, there are major protests continuing in Egypt this week.
Yes. Not elections. We mentioned that last week, where the emergency law was extended after the U.S. made all that noise in the last year about extending democracy to the Middle East and especially to Egypt. Well, we saw another example of Egyptian democracy and United States support for democracy at work yesterday, when demonstrators in Cairo were attacked by riot police while demonstrating in support of a couple of judges who are on trial for advocating an independent judiciary. Part of the problem with elections in Egypt is that the minister that oversees the judiciary, in other words, somebody who reports directly to Mubarak, oversees elections as well. And what the judges are advocating for is independent oversight of elections, which would sort of make sense if you want democracy. This is something that a lot of people in Egypt are really upset about, and the United States, true to George Bush's vision of a really leaning hard on its allies to become more democratic, said it was, quote, deeply concerned about the essentially police riot in Cairo yesterday.
All right. Unfortunately, very briefly, a couple developments in Africa.
Yeah, I'll blog about this at greater length, too, because it's truly outrageous. For anybody who read or saw the Constant Gardener, John le Carré's book and the movie based on it, it apparently is true to life. There's a Nigerian panel that came out this week with a report that Pfizer, the world's largest pharmaceutical company, was conducting unauthorized experiments on children suffering from meningitis in a backwater area of Nigeria in the mid-1990s. This for a drug that was later banned in the EU and severely restricted by the FDA for causing liver damage and leading to deaths. This is something that's really, really quite outrageous. Once again, you know, the West bringing democracy and freedom to Africa. And also over on sub-Saharan Africa, a report by Save Our Children this week concerning Liberia that follows up on a report from 4 years ago that identified the same problem, and reforms were supposed to be put in place, but girls as young as 8 years old being used for sex and having sex demanded of them by food aid workers and UN peacekeepers, as well as school teachers and other education officials, in exchange for food aid, in exchange for fees that enable somebody to go to school, in exchange even for good grades. The problem is said to be widespread, with over 50% of girls being victimized in a lot of villages in Liberia.
All right. All right. Talking once again with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
The half hour goes by quicker every week. Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. It is a free paper of news and opinion about global as well as local events. Volunteers put it out. You can also find us on the web and our blog with things we didn't get to today, and activist calendar, all that other good stuff. www.eatthestate.org.
And now, the man who brought down Nixon, Mike Cannon.
Okay, let's review, shall we? Our number one person at the CIA, Porter Goss, who shocked the United States with his resignation, in which he said, quote, "The reason why I'm resigning will remain a mystery." And his cronies, number three guy at the CIA, are all involved in the prostitution and gambling parties at the Watergate Hotel. Gee, another Republican illegal activities at the Watergate Hotel. Perhaps they should stay clear of that place. Another Republican congressman's aide pleading guilty and turning in more Republican congressmen on corruption charges. And Karl Rove being indicted for perjury and lying to investigators. Gee, now that's good old Republican values for you. By the way, I'm going to play you this short clip from a new Air Force general that Bush nominated for head of the CIA. He was the head of the NSA, and in this interview he insists that he knows and follows the Constitution, especially the Fourth Amendment. This was from an interview about 2 months ago. Again, listen to him insisting about how he knows all about the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. Yeah, let's have this guy run the CIA. Great pick, Eagle One.
The new CIA chief, expected to be General Michael Hayden, could be named as early as Monday.
My understanding is that the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause to be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful searches and seizures.
Actually, the Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
But that's what it says. The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable?
The legal standard
is probable cause.
Just to be very clear, okay, and believe me, if there's any amendment to the Constitution that employees of the National Security Agency are familiar with, it's the Fourth, right? And it is a reasonableness standard in the Fourth Amendment.
To quote the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States in its entirety, the one the General and the NSA folks are so familiar with and know is about reasonableness and not about probable cause, quote, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, no warrant shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized."
1, 2, 3.
Well, maybe they have a different constitution over there at the NSA.
Fourth Amendment of the Constitution specifies that you must have probable cause to be able to do a search that does not violate an American's right against unlawful searches and seizures.
Fourth Amendment actually protects all of us against unreasonable search and seizure.
But that's what it says. The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable? The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable? The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable? The measure is probable cause, I believe.
The amendment says unreasonable search and seizure.
But does it not say probable?
Well, maybe they have a different constitution over there at the NSA.
That was a segment from Mind Walk, a half-an-hour weekly stream of consciousness thing I try to bring you each week. The entire Mind Walk will be played at the end of the show. A quick brief summary of other stuff you'll be hearing on this week's Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. We'll have some stuff from the Labor Anti-War March last week in New York, where 300,000 labor groups from all over the country went to protest against this insane war. I guess everybody's jumping on the bandwagon now. A report about how bad this new Medicare drug thing mentioned in the Eat the State report just heard really is, and how good it is for big pharmaceutical companies. And Media Minutes will once again talk about the pressure to turn the internet into a pay-for-play pipeline, and guess who will be profiting from it. And a report about how cool it is to dumpster dive. These are just a few of the reports coming up on this alternative indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. We hope you like this alternative to corporate media, and hope that if you have any suggestions, comments, or gripes about the show, that you'll feel free to contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Coming up next, a short 7-minute environmental segment from the folks at EcoShock News, which will be followed by a 4-minute report about the Medicare sign-up deadline coming up today, and the corporate profiteering from it. As always, thanks for tuning in to this Indie Media Radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, normally heard starting at 2 p.m. every Monday. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock, and that is the sound of forests dying. In his best-selling book, The Weathermakers, Tim Flannery writes, "Among the most visible impacts of climate change anywhere on Earth are those brought by the spruce bark beetle. Over the past 15 years, it has killed some 40 million trees in southern Alaska, more than any other insect in North America's recorded history. Two hard winters are usually enough to control beetle numbers, but a run of mild winters in recent years has seen them rage out of control. The spruce budworm is another threat to the trees, the female budworms laying 50% more eggs at 77 degrees Fahrenheit than at 59 degrees Fahrenheit." End quote. Thanks to a new nature recording from EarthEar.com, we just tuned in to the intimate world of these tree killers, thriving unseen beneath the bark of our favorite conifers. It's a kind of music of mandibles and moving parts we don't yet understand. These are the sounds humans have never heard before. As an artist recording soundscapes, David Dunn began to focus on the pinyon pine, Pinus edulis, around his home in northern New Mexico. These striking dry weather pines are dying in great numbers, and most of them may die off in the next few years. The culprit is the pinion engraver beetle, with the scientific name Ipsus confusus, just the size of a grain of rice. Like many other beetles and borers in almost every other part of the world, these insects attack damaged and stressed trees. They leave crazed trails in the wood after the bark falls off. Until the last few years, wood beetles, budworms, and borers have been the forest cleanup crew of the weakest trees, as nature's design demands. They were limited by weather, especially by winters cold enough to kill them under the bark. Now, with milder winters, there is nothing to stop them. The conifers we grew up with are threatened and dying, and the public hardly knows about it. Life goes on in the cities while endless forests die off. Likely due to the stress of changing climate weakening the trees, such beetles are threatening to wipe out whole forests of pines all along the Rocky Mountains. In British Columbia, Canada, the pine borer is already turning vast mountains into a red funeral forest. Then the dry dead timber begins to burn, killing forests and its creatures. Conifers are under attack in Arizona and California, including the classic ponderosa pines. And as we've heard, the spruce bark beetle in Alaska has already killed over 40 million trees. If the temperature continues to rise, beetles may invade the five-needle pines higher in the mountains, killing off the jack pines of the northern states and Canada. Oceans of dead pine trees, we can hardly conceive of it. Why aren't we mourning? In the fascinating liner notes, David Dunn tells us, a serious infestation of the high-elevation conifers could substantially reduce the snow fence effect, windrows of captured snow, that these trees provide in the conservation and distribution of water from the Rocky Mountains. Since the Rocky Mountains serve as the headwaters for major river systems in North America, and the fact that most of their source water accumulates as winter snow, such tree loss may prove catastrophic. Dunn captured these never-before-heard sounds by implanting numerous tiny microphones right into the wood of trees. Our ears and regular microphones would never pick it up. We think that bugs under the bark of trees make noises for a variety of reasons. Perhaps sounds act as a spacing signal, just as robins will sing in a tree to claim enough space for nesting and immediate feeding. The beetles and borers need an area to eat without tunneling into other bugs. They may be sending other signals as well regarding reproduction. We just don't know. Yet beetles don't have ears. Scientists suspect they hear through mechanical hair-like attachments that sense the vibrations we call sound. The greater the infestation, the more sounds they make. Using this recording technique, we can discover beetle infestations before there are visible signs in the trees and even before the chemical markers previously studied in scientific research. It is also possible that beetles hear tree distress signals called cavitation events to find which trees to attack. Again, we don't know. We do know that beetles don't act alone to kill the trees. Their bodies also carry a variety of fungi called blue stain. It is this fungus which weakens the tree's vascular system and leaves the wood with a mild blue or purple stain. Some forest companies, encouraged by governments to cut dead trees before they burn, have tried to market fungi-stained wood as denim pine. The stain does not affect the structural integrity of the wood, but buyers shy away from purple pine wood, and the market is flooded as timber companies struggle to clear away entire watersheds of dead trees. It's a bonanza of clear-cutting without any environmental protest. The forest is already dead, and we hope to stop the insect plague. David Dunn hopes the art of beetle world will help science develop a way to save the trees from insects unleashed into previously immune forests by climate change. His album of beetle sounds, titled The Sound of Light in Trees, has just been released by EarthEar.com. When I first got the CD, I thought Jim Cummings and his crew have finally disappeared over some edge of nature recording. An hour of beetles talking and chewing? Where is the market for that? But it's eerie to start the CD playing and then find yourself half an hour later puttering at the computer or some other chore while the original Beatles move you along to their secret rhythms. More than a novelty or a scientific tool, this recording does have art. When technology finally allows us to hear it, Even the bugs make music. Perhaps everything is musical, if only we knew it. Tune in to Radio EcoShock, All Environment Radio, at www.ecoshock.org.
You know you only had one shot, to make it right, to do the right thing, so listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
We're from the government. We're here to make you sick. This is Jav Parrish. Next Monday, May 15th, marks the enrollment deadline for the new Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit. For the tens of millions of elderly, disabled, and low-income Americans who are eligible but who haven't yet enrolled in Part D, it's a critical date. The Bush administration's 2003 bill included, among many other dreadful provisions, a stipulation that after May 15th, anyone without certification of a better drug plan who fails to enroll in Part D will face a 1% per month penalty on their insurance premiums for every month after May 15th that they fail to enroll for the rest of their lives. After May 15th, enrollment will be closed until the end of the year, so for tens of millions of people who can least afford it, a minimum of 7% lifetime penalty will kick in for the 7 months between now and the end of the year, a so-called senior tax. It'll kick in if they don't enroll by Monday. I'm one of those people, and I'm not enrolling. I'm disabled. I'm a transplant patient. At present, I pay well over $5,000 a year, not including co-pays and other out-of-pocket expenses for my prescription drug coverage. But without coverage, it'd be well over $50,000 a year in any given year if I didn't have any complications. Medicare's Part D would actually save me a couple thousand a year, but I don't dare risk it. Why? Because once I pick one of the 47 or so private insurance plans available through Part D in Washington State, that plan can then change the list of drugs they're willing to cover at any time. And if they decide not to cover one of my expensive, life-giving drugs any longer, I can't do anything about it. I can't change plans for the rest of the year, and I'll simply have to pay for it myself. Meaning that instead of saving a couple of thousand, Part D would wind up costing me as much as $10,000 more for one drug. I have 20 they can mess with me on. And it's even worse for so-called dual-eligible patients, low-income folks eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. They were all forced off their much better Medicaid drug coverage and randomly assigned a Part D insurance plan, regardless of whether it actually met their needs. And if I can't make sense of all this, me, a relatively well-informed, healthcare-savvy, middle-aged guy, what about my 81-year-old mother? And if Mom, who's still pretty healthy and sharp, is befuddled by all this, and she is, how is somebody who's elderly and physically or mentally compromised supposed to cope with all this? Is it any wonder that nearly half of all eligible Americans haven't signed up for Part D yet, guaranteeing, as of next Monday, that minimum 7% lifetime surcharge? The Bush administration and many congressional Republicans couldn't be happier about all this. For them, it's working exactly as designed. The insurance companies will get that lifetime surcharge, not Medicare. The drug and insurance companies that wrote this 2003 bill are laughing all the way to the bank. How lucrative is it? Amazingly, Part D is prohibited by law from doing what every major drug buyer does, negotiating discounts with pharmaceutical companies based on quantity of purchase. Part D, by law, must pay Big Pharma full price, which is, as we all know too well, whatever the heck Pharma wants to charge. Call it welfare for very rich people. Lots of welfare for people who are now, thanks to this new program, rapidly becoming very, very rich. There are other major problems with Part D, too. I haven't even touched the infamous donut hole, the gap that requires patients pay nearly $3,000 in out-of-pocket expenses with no coverage before benefits resume. Try that while living on your monthly $880 Social Security disability check. The upshot is that the Medicare drug prescription plan is ghastly expensive for taxpayers, doesn't cover a lot of what it needs to, isn't serving and is therefore penalizing half the population it's supposed to serve, and is terribly confusing for anybody who's trying to navigate it. President Bush, naturally, has pledged to veto any changes to Part D. It's good to know whose side he's on. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Coming up next on the Mike Cannon Show, a fun little 6-minute piece on dumpster diving. Then we'll switch gears and go into a 3-minute This Week's Iraq Body Count, followed by a 2-minute report out of Palestine. These segments will take us to the top of the hour. So that's what we try to do for you each week on this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show, bringing you non-corporate voices from around the country and the world. Thanks for listening.
In today's world of rampant consumerism, vast amounts of food, clothing, and other material goods are thrown away every day. Dumpster diving, or scrounging, is a unique reaction to consumer culture. The daily process of reappropriating goods from the trash provides a means of subsistence, as well as an ideological resistance to consumer capitalism. In this audio collage, Sean McMahon examines the mental environment of dumpster divers and scroungers.
It's a far-flung, multifaceted world of scroungers, dumpster divers, trash pickers, street scavengers, scrap metal haulers, that sort of thing.
Basically, dumpster diving is a way to gather things of use that in a throwaway society such as the one we live in today.
And many scroungers, and certainly myself, see ourselves as sort of the last thin brown line between consumerism and the landfill.
Just, it seems ridiculous to me that the amount of things that are thrown away into society, like the amount of things that are produced and then just thrown away, whether it be food, clothes. I mean, you can basically get your basic necessities to live out of dumpsters, which is pretty sad, really, I think. I mean, it can benefit people, but at the same time, I think it points out a larger problem.
I again found just embarrassing waste of food.
To me, that just says, about this throwaway culture. And this, we produce so much and control so much of everything that we can't even get rid of the stuff we produce.
Almost anything, once again, you can imagine at a toy store or a hardware store or the mall is out there in the dumpster.
I mean, it's kind of confusing because on one hand, you see a lot of people that live in poverty and don't have anything, but yet at the same time, like perfectly good food, perfectly good clothes, I mean, anything from electronics to so much is produced and so much is thrown away that, it's just really sad.
Rather than scrounging being stigmatizing for people involved, I found that almost to a person, it was experienced as empowering and as a matter of dignity. Over and over again, scroungers said to me, hey, if it's this or minimum wage work at Walmart, I'd much rather have my cart and use my own, wiles to find the next aluminum can. So it seemed to me there was a very healthy kind of politics, a real sort of community of the trash piles, and a way in which people with very little resources were carving out a way to live their own lives on their own terms.
As far as trying to get people to resist this culture and, fight against this culture, and particularly to try and get people, poor people, people who are below the class, divisions, to have the opportunity to possibly resist and not just have to 100% think about where am I going to get food today, have that occupy their mind. So I think that's definitely where the anarchist politics fit into what Unabomber is doing.
Scrounging is a remarkably useful way to pull yourself out of the system, to need less, to be less dependent on bosses and jobs and insurance. And so I've always treasured my independence and sort of do-it-yourself autonomy. I try to live my life that way. And scrounging is just a remarkable way of living off the fat of consumerism, I guess you could say, or the waste that produces. And if we're going to live in that sort of society with all its inequities and all the harm it does, it seems to me one way we can sort of turn that back on itself is to learn to survive off of that.
Yeah, to me it's kind of that idea of like if you have knowledge on something, and there's nothing wrong with having knowledge as far as the whole power issue, but if you have that knowledge and you don't share, that's when that power, becomes that power issue. Like, of control over somebody, and that's how I see the society.
The thing that motivates me the most, it comes from a sensibility, I suppose, that comes from the situationist and anarchist political views, the situationists being, hellraisers of the 1960s in France and elsewhere, and that is the idea of the revolution of everyday life, that one way we perhaps can begin to change our lives and change society is by reinventing our lives as excitement and surprise and engagement, as opposed to boredom and dulling work. And so I found scrounging to be an adventure every day. It really does sort of recreate the banality of the city and dumpsters and neighborhoods and alleys into, again, as the scroungers say, into being a prospector and using your own wits and creativity to survive and be surprised by what you find. So on every level, I guess, it seems to fit who I want to be, and I hope maybe is a small step toward a different kind of society.
Jeff Farrell is a professor of sociology at Texas Christian University and the author of Empire of Scrounge. Rob is a dumpster diver who lives in San Francisco.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. For not being more perceptive. For not being aware enough. For not understanding. For being stupid. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. I can. But I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, they'd be not get left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists, dangerous, die. In terms of murders,
there are some who... I feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, May 15th, 2006, 2,437 United States military personnel had died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 17,649 United States military personnel had been wounded, over 5,000 of which had suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 211 other coalition forces had also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
This is a summary of Israeli war crimes committed in Palestine for the week ending 11 May 2006. Israeli occupation forces escalate attacks on Palestinian civilians and property in occupied Palestine. 9 Palestinians were killed by Israeli occupation forces this last week. Israeli occupation forces committed another extrajudicial assassination in the Gaza Strip. 24 Palestinian civilians, including 7 children and 3 women, were wounded by Israeli occupation gunfire. Israeli occupation forces continued to shell Palestinian areas in the Gaza Strip, particularly the northern area, wounding Palestinian civilians and damaging a number of homes and civilian facilities. Israeli occupation forces conducted 38 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank, particularly Nablus. 61 Palestinian civilians, including 11 children, were arrested by Israeli occupation forces. 7 homes and a school were transformed by the Israeli military into military sites. Israeli occupation forces have continued to impose a total siege in occupied Palestine and have continued to close border crossings of the Gaza Strip. The north of the West Bank has been separated from the south, and Israeli occupation forces arrested 9 Palestinian civilians, including 4 children, at checkpoints in the West Bank. Israeli occupation forces have also continued to construct the annexation or apartheid wall in the West Bank and have continued to construct sections of the wall around Jerusalem near the Ariel settlement. And Israeli occupation forces use force against peaceful, nonviolent demonstrators organized around protest of the construction of the apartheid wall. Lastly, Israeli settlers have continued to attack Palestinian civilians and property in occupied Palestine. 9 Palestinian children were wounded in such attacks in the Hebron area. For more details of these gross war crimes and human rights violations, you can go to www.pchrgaza.org.